Lecture 19, Augustine, Grace and Free Will, Professor Philip Carey.
We come now to a great mind who was perhaps the most influential mind in the Western Christian tradition. He stands there at the beginning of a distinctively Western Christian tradition, as opposed to the Eastern Christian tradition that leads to Greek Orthodoxy and Russian Orthodoxy. Augustine is his name. He's really a founding figure for both Roman Catholics and Protestants, that is, for the whole Western Christian tradition. He was Bishop of Hippo in North Africa in the late Roman Empire in the 4th century A.D. He later became known as a church father. That means basically one of the teachers of the Christian faith at the beginning of the formation of the Western Christian tradition, who was just immensely influential in giving shape to the way Western Christians, both Catholics and Protestants, think about God and the soul and what links the two of them. In addition to being this immensely influential and authoritative figure in the Western tradition, and he really is the most important authority for the Middle Ages after the Bible, in addition to being this imposing authoritative figure, he is also one of the most passionate souls in the history of the Western tradition. He tells us what his passionate soul is like. He sort of displays it for us in his book, The Confessions, which is perhaps, the first great spiritual autobiography of the West. It displays his lostness, his straying from God and his coming back to God in terms that are immensely passionate, moving. Augustine is a man with a deep mind and a deep heart, and that makes him very attractive for a lot of his readers. His mind is always alive and always questioning. His heart is always on fire, and his mind is on fire. And his heart is on fire sometimes with the wrong kind of love, and that makes his story a real drama. And he is also, very interestingly and very importantly, a thinker who draws from both the biblical tradition, right? The Bible is the authoritative book for Augustine, but also from the Greek philosophical tradition. He didn't know much of Plato or Aristotle, but he did read Plotinus and was deeply influenced by Plotinus's spirituality. So Augustine is a Christian Platonist who forms the Western tradition in part by providing a synthesis between Greek thought and biblical thought. In fact, there's no single figure who's more influential in creating that synthesis than Augustine. Augustine's story of his lost soul in the Confessions is a lostness that you can understand in Plotinian terms. Think of Plotinus' image from the last lecture of the many souls facing outward, away from that divine center. The outward world, the external world, is a world of darkness, metaphorically. It's a world of bodies, literally. And when you're engaged in that outward world through desire, lust, pain, and pleasure, you are forgetful of what lies within. And that's one of the key dynamics of the story Augustine tells in the Confessions. He sums up, in many ways, the whole of his life at a key point in the 10th book of the Confessions when he says, "You were within me, but I was outside." Right? Amazing image. He was outside himself, out among all those pretty, beautiful bodies. He calls them temporal beauties, right? Beauties that belong to time. But God was inside, more interior to me than I was to myself, he will say at one point, right? God is more inward in us than we are to ourselves. Because we are mostly outside ourselves, grasping for all those outward beauties, where the true inward beauty shines within and we are looking away from it to the outside world. So the external things of this world for Augustine are temptations. And yet, they're not evil. This is very crucial for Augustine. They are beautiful and good, right? Those things out there are beauties. Temporal beauties, not eternal beauties, but they are beauties because God made them, right? And God doesn't make anything ugly and bad. Everything out there is good and beautiful, right? In fact, Augustine will say everything that exists is good because, after all, God made everything that exists. So in that sense, Augustine rejects a certain style of dualism, which you can see in Plato, when Plato, for instance, calls the body evil. Right? Augustine will never do that. He rejects a kind of dualism that he knew in extreme form in a group called the Manichaeans, who were very briefly a group of Christians, or they called themselves Christians, the Orthodox Catholics called them heretics. They thought that the body was absolutely filthy. The body was evil, dirty, foul. You know, think of all that blood and guts and filth. You know, you open up a body and it's ugh, right? And the soul is stuck, imprisoned in that body. The soul is a fragment of divine light, pure and clean, stuck in that filthy body. That's the heresy that Augustine was part of as a young man, because he thought it was more spiritual than the kind of Catholicism he grew up with, which was kind of a backwoods kind of Catholicism. You know, imagine a Catholic priest who knows his catechism but can't really argue philosophy with a bright young man like Augustine, who was growing up as your stereotypical snot-nosed kid, right? He knew he was smarter than the local priest. He asked some tough questions to the local priest, and the priest couldn't answer it, right? So he decided he'd be more spiritual, right? He doesn't believe in this kind of materialistic, worldly. And the Catholicism of his time was already a worldly and powerful social force. Now, he was more spiritual than that. He was looking for something better than the foul stuff of this world. Well, he ended up changing his mind, and by the time he was writing the Confessions, he had firmly rejected that kind of dualism, and he affirmed that everything that exists, including especially the body, is good, because God made it. So that, in fact, comes from Genesis 1, chapter 1 of Genesis, where God looks at the world he made and said, it's good. Right? Now, it's interesting, Plotinus can be combined with that biblical notion, because for Plotinus, everything comes from the one, and although bodies are less good than the soul, which is less good than the intellect, which is less good than the one, nonetheless, bodies are an offshoot, the furthest offshoot from the one. They reflect the beauty and goodness of the intelligible world. So that's a viewpoint that can be combined with the Orthodox Christian understanding of the goodness of the world. What it can't be combined with is another thing which seems to me to be part of what's in Genesis 1 and 2, and that's the notion that God creates the world as our home. If you read through Genesis 1 and 2, the first two chapters of the Bible, it looks like God is creating a home for the human race. But for Augustine, as for Plotinus, you could say what the old hymn says, this earth is not my home. This world is not my home. That's where Augustine and Plotinus, I think, have a spirituality that looks rather different than the Bible. Although, if you believe in the Augustinian spirituality, as of course many Christians do, then you can read the Bible in a more spiritual way. You use what is called a letter spirit hermeneutics, which is very popular among church fathers and among Christian Platonists, to read a more spiritual meaning into the Bible, especially the Old Testament, which seems to be suggesting, you know, that happiness consists in getting to the promised land and living on milk and honey, right? Which seems to be a very carnal way of thinking of happiness. Well, if you're a Platonist, you want to say that's a symbol of something more spiritual. Right? The promised land of Israel certainly is not our home for these Christian Platonists, in contrast to Jews, for whom it really is home. But for Christian Platonists, the promised land is not our home, not literally. The promised land is a symbol of a spiritual realm, which is our home. We'll talk about what exactly that means in a minute. Now, think a second about this inner-outer stuff that Augustine talks about. We're familiar with the inner-outer distinction in the modern world. We talk about it all the time. But I hope that the Plotinian version of the inner-outer, which we discussed earlier in the previous lecture, is a little bit unfamiliar. Right? The inner world for Plotinus is the world of the divine mind. It's Augustine who gives us the inner-outer distinction as we now know it, the notion of a private inner world, a world in which I enter into myself and I find not the mind of God, but just my own inner world, private inner world. That's because Augustine is attracted to Plotinus, but he knows that as an Orthodox Catholic, he can't accept all of Plotinus. He's really attracted to this image of turning inward, right? Of finding God in the self instead of out there in the physical world. But when Augustine turns inward, he can't just sort of turn inward and say, that's God. Because for Augustine, as for any Orthodox Catholic, the soul is not God. The soul is not divine. The soul is something God made. And therefore, the soul is fundamentally and eternally other than God. So you can't turn into your own self and find God, at least not directly. So for Augustine, instead of just turning inward and seeing God, or being united with God, as in Plotinus, you turn inward and then look upward. There's a movement in, then up. That is, you enter this private inner world of yourself and look upward at that divine sun, again that Platonic image, the divine sun which shines above your mind, because the divine sun is God. He made your mind, and therefore he is above your mind, right? He's above your mind because he's the one who created it. So there's this double movement. Instead of just a turn inward, there's a turn inward and then a look upward. And that means that the inner space of the soul is our own space. It's not the same thing as the mind of God, right? So therefore, we have a private inner space, our own inner world. It's the world of memory, Augustine will say, as well as imagination and thinking, right? The first thing we see when we enter into our own mind is our own private thoughts, which other people can't see. And it's when we look upward that we see what everyone can look up, everyone can see inwardly if they enter into themselves and look upward. So the initial stage when you're in but not yet looking up is your private inner world. And that's, I think, the origin of modern thinking about the inner self as a private inner realm. Now, when you do get into yourself and then look up, what's happening? Well, it's that same notion of intellectual vision that you have in Plato and Plotinus, I think. This is controversial, but I see too much in common between Augustine, Plotinus, and Plato here to ignore it. This is intellectual vision. This is the mind's eye looking at the form of the good, that sun that shines down on the world of the forms. Augustine will call this... Oh, I'm sorry. It's not Augustine who calls it this. The Catholic tradition later will call it beatific vision. We'll call it the vision that makes us happy. That's what beatific means. But it's an intellectual vision. It's a vision of the mind's eye, of the intellect. Now, we can't get the beatific vision simply by turning inward and looking upward in this life. The beatific vision is the state of being we have in what could metaphorically be called heaven. Right? Augustine doesn't literally believe our souls go up to heaven. Right? That's a picture. The literal truth is that heaven... eternal life consists in seeing God with our mind's eye. That's beatific vision. Right? That's what heaven really is. That's what all the imagery in the Bible is about. But it is something like leaving the realm of this world to another world. But we don't get to have a permanent beatific vision until after death. In this life, when our minds are deeply imperfect and clouded by sin, when we enter into ourselves and look up, we might catch a glimpse of God. We might not. We might just sort of be stuck in the dirt in our own souls. But we might look up, catch a glimpse of God, but it's so bright, right? The sun shining so bright that we're dazzled. The mind's eye cannot take in all that light. And it's like looking at the sun. It darkens your eyes. It dazzles your eyes. You have to look away. So the experience of, aha, I see it, the experience of beatific vision, or rather, I'll call it a beatific glimpse, right? This glimpse of God's being, which Augustine describes, is followed immediately by this experience of dazzlement, of falling back down into the region of darkness and unlikeness to God. So Augustine describes that kind of, well, you can call it a mystical experience, right? But it's an intellectual experience of the mind taking in more light than it can bear. But when our minds are perfected after death, then we'll be able to take in all of that light and enjoy it forever. So that's Augustine's picture of what we're aiming for, right? What is our life about? Right? We think our life is about all these beautiful things in the external world, but what it's really about is seeing God. And we need to make that movement away from those external things toward God. And the Confessions is the story of how that happens. But now we need to add another element to the story, another conceptual element. We've been talking about intellect, understanding, inner and outer. But now we need to talk about love. Because after all, what's the force that drives this movement, right? The force that drives all movements of the soul is love. Whenever the soul moves in any direction, inward, outward, upward, it's moved by love. And the part of the soul that does the loving is called the will. Right? Free will, or the will for short, is that aspect of ourselves which loves, whereas the intellect is that aspect of ourselves which understands. So love is the motive force. Love is what drives us and moves us toward what we love. Right? Love is like an engine moving us toward the thing we love. Augustine will say in a famous passage in the Confessions, my love is my weight. Right? And in ancient physics, weight could drive you downward, but weight could also drive you upward. Right? Fire, remember, you know, it has a weight that drives you upward. Earth has a weight that goes downward. Fire goes upward. And love for God, charity, in Augustine's technical terminology, is like a fire in the heart that drives our hearts upward toward God. Right? Whereas love for material things is like making our hearts muddy and stony and thud, down to earth we go among things that are dirty and mortal and deadly. So, love is this motive force, and it has the effect, or the aim, it has first the aim and then the effect, of uniting us with what we love. Love is a unifying force. Right? And again, this notion of unity is very crucial for Augustine, as it is for Plotinus. Love unites us with what we love. It sort of glues us to what we love. We kind of glom on to what we love. The way, most importantly, one friend and another friend are glued together by love so that they become one heart, one soul. Right? Love seeks happiness by uniting itself with what it loves. Love drives our souls to unite ourselves with what we love and seek our happiness there. Seek what Augustine will call rest. Right? Because love is restless, but it wants to find rest in its beloved. So Augustine will say at the beginning of the Confessions in a famous passage, our hearts are restless until they find rest in thee, that is, in God. Because if you see, we've got this problem. We love these things out in the external world, and they're transitory, shifting, mortal, deceptive, right? And so we've got this problem that the happiness we long for can only be had really in a stable and eternal and satisfying way by glomming onto God, right? The love of God leads us to glom onto this thing that will really make us happy, right? God in beatific vision. But instead, most of us, most of the time, including Augustine, glom onto things out here in the external world that won't make us happy, right? I mean, you can think of this quite obviously. Some people glom onto money, right? As if gathering as much money to oneself will make one happy. Well, we all know that's not true. There's a temporary happiness to it, right? But it's not going to make people ultimately happy, right? That's true for most of the sort of sensual pleasures, right? You glom onto this stuff, but it's not going to make you happy very long. You know, Augustine has the example of a drunk man he meets in the street who was happy for a while until the hangover woke him up. But Augustine himself at the time was a young man on the make. He was a social climber, and he said, I was in much worse state than the drunkard because I was trying to glom on to wealth, riches, power. And it was much harder to undeceive myself about that, to get out of this deceptiveness. The drunkard, he woke up the next morning, he knew he wasn't happy, but I thought that I was pursuing happiness in this false life. All right, so we need to discover where the real truth is, where the real happiness is, where our true love lies. When we glom onto these things that don't give us real happiness, that is called sin. Right? It's not that we shouldn't love things at all other than God, but we shouldn't try to find ultimate happiness in them. Right? And the punishment for trying to find ultimate happiness in things that don't give us ultimate happiness is that we don't get the thing we're looking for. Right? The most striking example of this is in the best love of all, other than the love of God. Right? The love of God, of course, is the best love, but there's the second best love, and the second best thing in the universe, really, is friendship, which is a form of love for Augustine, as it is for Aristotle and all other ancient thinkers. So when we unite ourselves with our friend, this is sweet and lovely and far better than, you know, money or pleasure or any of those other things. It's the best thing next to uniting with God. But your friend is mortal. Glom onto your friend, and just like everything else, you will lose because you're loving what is mortal as if it could make you eternally happy. That's Augustine's message. And he gets this message across in one of the most amazing passages in Western literature. Augustine is one of the great poets of grief because he knows firsthand what it's like to glom on to some mortal thing and try to find ultimate happiness in this thing which necessarily is going to slip through his fingers because it's mortal, even his friend. Right? And that's the hardest lesson of all and the deepest grief of all. Here's how he describes it. At this sorrow, my heart was utterly darkened, and whatever I looked upon was death. My native country was a torture to me, and my father's house was a marvelous unhappiness. He was a teenager this time. And whatever I had participated in with my friend, now, since it lacked him, was turned into a frightful torment. My eyes looked for him everywhere, but he was not given to them. I hated all places because he was not in them. Nor could these places now say to me, "Look, he's coming," as they did when he was alive and absent. Imagine this picture of the whole world as an absence, the absence of the one you love who has now died. Augustine continues, "I became a great question to myself. And I asked my soul, why was she so sad? Why was she so exceedingly troubled within me? But she knew not how to answer me." That's the result of a wayward and disordered love. Even love for friends, if we put it above love for God, it will make us miserable. All loves other than God, if we put it first, will make us miserable. So what we need, Augustine thinks, and now we go from the dark side, the wandering, the lostness, to grace, to happiness. The crucial turning point is, in fact, to turn the soul and its will, a turning of the will from these external beauties to the inner beauty of God. All we have to do is decide to turn our own will. A mere turning of the will is all that's needed. And as Augustine says in one of his early works, well, what's more in our control than our own will? That was an early optimistic statement. By the time he gets to the Confessions, it's much more complicated, much more difficult. It turns out that we are not in full control of our own will, for Augustine, right? Because love forms habits. We get in the habit of, say, drinking too much every evening, right? If you're in that habit, you find it a hard habit to break. Augustine found the habit of sex hard to break. He had been living with a woman for 15 years. It was hard to turn away from that and turn wholly to God. Any habit of love is a habit that's hard to break. And that means that our wills become divided against themselves, right? On the one hand, we want to say, I want to turn my whole will to God. On the other hand, there's this lingering attachment, right? This sort of glue that makes it hard to pull away. Augustine describes this in a memorable passage in Book 8 of the Confessions, where he's describing the events leading to his conversion. He pictures it as something like what happens when you're trying to wake up. And you know you're supposed to wake up. The wiser and better part of yourself says, hey, it's time to get up. Come on, you got to get up. It's the right thing to do. It's the thing you have to do. It's the thing that will ultimately make you happier. You're not going to be happy staying asleep all day. Come on, wake up, wake up. Then the other part of you says, oh, just a little while longer. I'll wake up soon, but not yet, not yet. Let me hit the snooze button. Right? So there's these two sides of yourself, this division within yourself. It's only one self. It's only one will. And yet it's fighting against itself. And Augustine is one of the great poets of that conflict, the inner conflict of will. The wanting to wake up and find the truth, but also the lingering, luscious pleasure of just staying half asleep. Now, that means, you see, that we cannot turn our own wills on our own. So, how are our wills going to turn to God? We want to turn our will to God, but we can't succeed entirely, at least not by ourselves. So that's where grace comes in. And here's a crucial Augustinian notion. He gets it from Paul. He gets the language from Paul and some of the ideas, right? But he forms his own doctrine of grace. I think it's a fundamentally new way of thinking about grace that becomes absolutely crucial for later Western thought. The idea is this. Here's Augustine's reasoning. If I delighted enough in God, I would find it easy to turn from these other loves to God, right? If you're falling in love with God, as some people do, well, then it's easy to give up these other things, right? So what you need is something that will set your heart afire with love for God. And you can't just choose to fall in love. Plato observed this a long time ago, right? And there's a Platonic element in this notion of grace, right? We cannot just choose what we will delight in, because we have too many of these old carnal habits of delighting in external things. So grace is God's inward gift, right? He gives it to us inwardly so that our will finds it sweet and delightful to love God more than anything else, right? So grace basically means the gift of falling in love with God, And as Augustine will say, all things are easy for love. Right? If you are just passionately in love with God, you're going to find it easy to give up drinking or old girlfriends or money or whatever, right? All those carnal things that attract you away from God. So you see what's happening here, I think, is you've got Augustine taking Paul's talk about grace and interpreting it partly in terms of Platonic love, right? Of this love which desires these higher truths and which is like falling in love, right? Remember how in Plato, the love for eternal beauty is something we remember and are reminded of by our love for earthly beauties. So falling in love is something that is fundamental for Platonic spirituality. And what we have to fall in love with above all is eternal truth, God. Now you notice this means that grace and free will are compatible in an important way, right? When God gives us grace, it turns our will to what we really want. Right? It helps us wake up. Right? It gives us the freedom to wake up and fight that lower and more carnal and more pleasure-seeking part of ourselves. So grace does not overcome free will, but it helps free will to do what it really wants to do. But it does mean that free will is not sufficient by itself. Without the help of grace, our free will is not going to find God. So grace strengthens and sets free our free will. But it does mean that free will is not sufficient, and that's very important for Augustine. Free will is not enough to get us to God. So in the larger doctrinal framework that Augustine develops in some of his later works, he works on an interpretation of justification by faith, right? That Pauline notion that we noticed in the letters of Paul, which focuses on how grace leads us to love God. It all begins with faith, which then causes us to pray, right? In faith to God, believing that God will help us, we pray for grace, as Augustine did when he was struggling to wake up in that conversion scene. He prays for grace. God gives you the gift of grace, and that causes you to love God, and that is obedience to the commandment, right? The great commandment to love God with your whole heart, mind, and strength. So loving God in that way is righteousness, right? Remember that key term from Paul. Righteousness consists in obeying the commands of God, which consists in loving God. So through this process, which begins with faith, you end up becoming righteous. That is, you're loving God as you're supposed to. And that will eventually lead you to the beatific vision. So this process, Augustine calls justification by faith. And this is what he thinks Paul is talking about. I suggested when I talked about Paul in an earlier lecture that that's not really what Paul had in mind. But it becomes the fundamental understanding of Paul in the Western Christian tradition. It certainly has a lot in common with Paul, but it's fundamentally about the relation of God and the soul and not about the relation of Jews and Gentiles in the Christian community, as Paul's concern was. But Augustine will adopt Paul's contrast, his language in which he contrasts living under the law and living by grace. Living under the law means trying to love God by your own free will and by doing good works and all that sort of thing. And living under grace means praying for grace, being justified by grace, and learning to love God by falling in love with Him through this gift of grace. Now, late in Augustine's career, a crucial question gets asked. So far, I've been portraying justification by faith as this process that starts with belief and leads to love and leads ultimately to God Himself, to the beatific vision. Now, the big question is, if it starts with faith, does that mean that the process that leads to our salvation and justification starts with us? Our decision to have faith. At that initial point, is it up to us to get the whole ball rolling by having faith, just deciding to believe in God, deciding to pray? Augustine avoided answering that question for a long time because he wanted to say, look, our will is an active participant, right? Our love is what drives us. But he also wanted to say, salvation is by grace. Right? We can't do it without God's help. So at this initial moment, that first decision for God, what is it that happens? What is it that causes what? Is grace first or is faith first? And Augustine in the later work says, grace is first. We cannot even believe without the gift of grace. Before we even ask for grace, we have to have grace even to ask. Right? If we pray for grace, that's because God has given us the grace to have faith and pray. So grace is, as the technical language puts it, prevenient. It comes from a Latin term meaning to come before. Grace comes before even our decision to believe. It makes everything possible. So we cannot save ourselves. Right? Salvation from beginning to end is fundamentally a work of God rather than ourselves. Right? If you're someone who is aware, has a deep sense of your own sinfulness and weakness, this can be very comforting. I'm not strong enough to save myself, someone like Luther will say. Right? And so the thought that God, from beginning to end, is the one who's determined to save you, that's great. The problem is when you think about those to whom God does not give grace, which we discussed, you know, in talking about Paul, right? God doesn't give grace to everyone. And that leads to the question about predestination. That leads to the question about, well, why does God give grace to some and not to others? Well, he is gracious and he doesn't owe grace to anyone, right? No one deserves grace. And so he gives grace to some undeserving sinners and not to others. This is unequal treatment, but it's not unjust. Because those who don't get grace get punished for their own sins. And those who do get grace get undeserved mercy. So no one gets less than they deserve, and a lot of people get more than they deserve. That's Augustine's justification for it. But it does lead to this question about predestination, this anxiety. Am I one of those predestined to be saved, or one of the others? We'll return to that question and that anxiety when we get to the Protestant theologians Luther and Calvin.